Thank you. It's always embarrassing when the applause you get before you speak are longer than the applause you get after you speak. And so we don't want to. But, well, before you leave, let me get a few words in here. Let me say. I wanted to talk about empire, because there's an enormous disparity between what empires actually do and how they're represented in history, and even how this one is represented today, as you know, how they're represented by their leaders and their chroniclers. Okay, there's the mic. Empires, I noticed, are actually presented to us as creations of peace. They're even named after peace. Pax Romana, Pax Britannica, and there's even Pax Americana. That is, this is a period of peace where one rule prevailed over the world. Empires are represented as bringing stability, justice, and prosperity to their subject peoples. They're represented as selfless things, large, impersonal organizations that bring order where there once had been disorder. Edward Gibbon, who wrote the great masterpiece, politically terrible book, but it's great to read anyway, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He gives a perfect example of the mythology of empire. This is what he says about Rome. I quote this in my book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. I have some of this. So these are crib notes from the book. All right. But he says, the obedience of the Roman world was uniform, voluntary, and permanent. The vanquished nations blended into one great people, resigned the hope, nay, even the wish of resuming their independence. The vast Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. Yeah, right. Yeah. See, not a word here. Not a word here about an empire that's built, an empire of shattered armies, sacked towns, enslaved prisoners of war, mercilessly overtaxed populations, slaughtered herds, raped women, burnt crops, whatever else. 1877, John Morley, an English political leader and writer, talks about the British Empire. We have had imposed upon us the unlucky prowess of our ancestors. I should translate that sentence, that what I've said so far. Meaning, the power and the efficacy of our ancestors has imposed upon us. See, empires are never pursued ruthlessly and carved out and all that. They're just imposed on people. It's fine, we have an empire. Yeah. So, we have had imposed upon us by the unlucky prowess of our ancestors the task of ruling a vast number of millions of alien dependents. We undertake it with a disinterestedness and execute it with a skill of administration to which history supplies no parallel. You see, and that's interesting by calling them dependents, because in fact you are working these people to death. You're expropriating from them. They're supporting your luxuries and your incredible surplus wealth with their labor and deprivation. But you call them our dependents. You reverse the roles. You say, we are taking care of them. Empires are sometimes represented as unintentional conglomerates, the product of unconscious circumstance. And there's an awful lot of that in political thinking in America today. That it's all unintended consequence, that it's all mix-up, foul-up, lack of information. Oh, what do you have, a conspiracy? You think they're actually thinking about these things? Deliberate. But it's unconscious circumstance. The British Empire, when I was a kid, I heard the British Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. How the hell do you put an empire together in a fit of absent-mindedness? Cyril Robinson, a British historian, says that, and a classicist, I take him to task in my book on Caesar and the Roman Empire, and the Roman Republic, actually, where I wrote about. Robinson says the same thing about the Roman Empire. He says, it was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain, that she acquired her world domination in a fit of absence of mind. And we hear that today about the United States, that the United States was reluctantly thrusted onto the world stage as world leader. They were thrusted into the role of world leader. They never say who did the thrusting. Generations of Americans were taught to think of empire and imperialism as something that other countries do. Imperialism is the process of empire. That's what empires do. They do imperialism. And imperialism really is when the ruling interests of one country expropriate the land, the labor, the resources, the markets, and the capital of another country. This is what other countries did. So there was the Roman Empire, the British Empire, the Mongol Empire, the Spanish Empire, and the one that was painted as the most repressive and deadly, the one that was really a bad empire, there was the Soviet Empire. Remember that? Which came apart when 100,000 people marched in Moscow. This ruthless, power-hungry Soviet Empire, which in fact is not even around anymore. But there was no American empire. I remember my teacher, Grace A. Myers, in the sixth grade, telling us the United States is one of the very few countries in the world that does not have colonies. We have possessions. That was the term we were going. We have... And we had maps on the wall in PS 85 in New York City. Alaska was then, it wasn't a state, and Hawaii, and they were called territories. We had possessions and we had territories. We didn't have colonies. We weren't colonialists. This denial was made easier by the innovation of neo-colonialism or neo-imperialism. Almost a half a century before the British thought of doing it in India, the Americans were doing this in the Sandwich Islands, better known to you as Hawaii, and then later on doing it in Cuba. And Puerto Rico. No, not Puerto Rico. They didn't do it in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is a possession. It's a commonwealth. Compañero. They did it in Cuba. They said... They went to the Cubans and they said, listen, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, but it doesn't look so good. We're a republic and it doesn't look good. We have colonies and all that. So we're going to give you your independence. And you're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue. You get only one star because you're just a little island, you know. You have your own presidente, you're going to have your own Congress, you have your Guardia Civile, we'll train and arm and show them how to beat up and kill your citizens, the ones that get out of line and all that. And you have your own money. You don't have to put George Washington on it. You can put Jose Marti, anybody you want. We're flex. You can put this general, that general. You can put Cubans on your own money. And all we are going to have in exchange is we will own your sugar industry, your tobacco industry, your nickel minings, your oil refineries, and we control all your imports and exports and your tourist industry. But you're independent now. There you go. That's what neo-imperialism is, where you give the country the accoutrements of independence while you control that country's land, labor, natural resources, and wealth. Or the better part of it, anyway. But why should the U.S. be called an empire, some said? Isn't it enough to call it a superpower? But it's a superpower that exercises that power through direct and indirect intervention into the affairs of these countries to actually change their developments, to actually rob them of their futures and change their future, change their interior conditions, their political arrangements, their social institutions. Well, why are there these empires? Why do these people do this? I already answered the question, I think. But it's interesting, you can read all sorts of accounts about empires, and you can read all sorts of accounts about empires in general and all that. And nobody asks the question, but why do they arise? You hear descriptions, and the Mongols came down through here, and this happened here, and then they went into this country, and they took that and all. But why do they do all this? Why do they exert themselves in this way, killing large numbers of people? Is it just all about conquest? Is it conquest for conquest's sake? Power for power's sake? Actually, no. Power is mostly an instrumental value. Very few instances in history where they pursue power just for the sake of power. Oh, individuals climb up the power ladder, fight up the greasy pole, fighting their way up the greasy pole, as Disraeli called it. They want office, they want fame. But the actual policies they have to pursue also involve something else. There are real material interests at stake. Plunder, tribute, resources, markets, expropriating the land, the crops, the cheap labor, or as in ancient times, not so ancient actually, even still today, the slave labor. The UN report shows there must be about 24 countries where slavery still exists in one form or another. Empires are enormously profitable for the ruling class. Empires are enormously costly for the common populace. We see that today, right this time, right now that's happening. The war in Iraq is not a failure. The war in Iraq is very profitable for certain people. It canceled every foreign concession and contract with China, Russia, France, Malaysia, Italy, Brazil. And every one of those concessions now belong to American companies, and they're taking out billions of dollars of oil. It's very profitable. It's also very costly for us. $166 billion in less than a year we are going to have to pony up to pay the cost of repressing those people. And they don't care it costs so much because we're paying the cost and they're skimming the cream on it. And that's why you shouldn't say the way John did up there, John Stockwell, my friend. He shouldn't say, he's always in that bad habit, and a lot of people do that. Howard Zinn does it, Chomsky does it, so many of them. We did this and then we did that, we did this. It's not we, there's no community of interest we have in this empire. We're among the victims too. I'm doing that. And the empire feeds off the resources of the republic. That's what the empire feeds off. That's what sustains the empire. And every gun, every plane, every Humvee that gets blown up, every missile that gets fired there, that's just that much less for school funds and that much less for public hospitals and that much less for human services and all. And that's okay with them because that's just what they don't want. They want a big deficit. A deficit is a way of privatizing the public budget. That means a larger and larger chunk of every tax dollar you have goes to rich creditors. We are borrowing money from the people we should be taxing. It's a very rational system. That's why you have conservatives racking up these huge deficits. Ronald Reagan came in with an $800 billion national debt. The national debt is the accumulation of yearly deficits. A deficit is when the government pays out more than it takes in. How can it do that? By borrowing money from rich creditors. The same people whose taxes you cut, you now go to them and borrow money. It's a safe form of investment for them. Full faith and credit of the U.S. government backs their money, and they can put it in, and they can collect enormous amounts of interest on it. The bigger the deficit, when Reagan left office, that national debt was at 200, 2.5 trillion dollars, from 800 billion to 2.5 trillion. Today it's upwards of 6 trillion. And George Bush is running a half a trillion a year, practically, or more. They want to do that. It absolutely subverts the public budget. They know that the military budget is untouchable because they just got to tell people this keeps you alive against all those evil threats. And so it's going to come out of human services. It also then serves the function then of cutting back on human services. That slime bag, Alan Greenspan just the other day started talking about how we got to cut back on Medicare and Social Security because of this deficit, you see. So this is where it's going. Well, so there's people who live very well off empire. I thought we were going to see this film on Mossadegh tonight. We didn't see it. But I remember I ran into an Iranian woman just a few years ago. She'd lived very well under the Shah. She left after 1979 when the Shah was booted out and all that. And she talked about things. She seemed like a very intelligent, sensitive woman. So I said, well, what was life actually? Because I had Iranian grad students at Cornell back in 70-something. And when it came up the question of the Shah, all I saw was in newspapers, the Shah, the great modernizer, the Shah, friendly to the West, the Shah of Iran, the Pahlavi, what great guy, a modernizer, you know, all that stuff. And these students would start, when I talked about, I raised the question of the Shah, they would get livid. I mean, the veins would probably say, hate him, we could kill him. And they start telling me stories of a friend, a cousin disappeared at the airport, the Savak torturers and this and that. I said, I don't hear any of this in the U.S. media. This Shah, who gets his picture taken with every American president, with Senator Kennedy, with all sorts of political leaders and all that, this Shah, there's something more I'm not hearing here. And then they overthrew him. So I said to this very nice lady, I said, what was life under the Shah? And by the way, these students were from pretty good families. I mean, good. I mean, affluent families themselves. You don't go to Cornell graduate school from Iran unless you got some bucks. And so I said, what was life like under the Shah? And she said, perfect. Perfect. And you know, as I got a description of it, I put it together. It was perfect. She was rich. She had a state, she had a country place she went to. She had a small army of servants who you pay a few pennies a day because they're so desperate to have to work hard. And she paid no taxes. One of the things Mossadegh did was he tried to tax rich Iranians. And they tried to confiscate their property if they refused to pay the taxes. Well, that's the class. She was of that class of empire. They exist in all these countries. It's not the Americans versus the Nicaraguans. It's the rich American plutocrats in collusion with the rich Nicaraguan and Iranian and Iraqian and Brazilian and Venezuelan plutocrats versus the people of all those countries, including our own. So that class becomes a crucial unit. In recent years, it's actually become respectable for conservative pundits to say that we have an empire. Grace A. Myers would be shocked. My sixth grade teacher would be. But you actually hear them saying this. And, you know, having the power, if I understand them rightly, since we have the power, this gives us a sense of entitlement. We're the strongest nation in the world, and we have every right to act as such. You hear them saying things like that. Meaning you can go and whack anybody who's weaker than you. We're an empire with all the obligations and opportunities and responsibilities of empire, and we better get used to it. Sometimes it's not an entitlement, but a reluctant obligation, a mantle thrown on our shoulders by history. I already told you that one about it's just been thrusted on us and like that. Now, since World War II, the U.S. government has given some $240 billion in military aid to train and equip millions of troops and internal security forces and police forces in some 100 or more countries. Why? not to defend them from outside invasion, since very few of them were ever threatened by attack from neighboring nations, but to protect. I mean, Honduras wasn't attacking El Salvador. El Salvador wasn't ready to invade Nicaragua. Nicaragua wasn't going to attack Mexico. It was really just to protect the ruling oligarchs and multinational corporate investors from the dangers of domestic insurgency. How can we make that determination of intent? I'm imputing a certain intent. That's why it was done. And the question of intent is always a difficult one in politics, because no one has ever seen an intention or a motive. It's a non-empirical thing. Intent is always ascribed or inferred or imputed. You can't see intent. It's non-empirical. I mean, you can see George Bush invading Iraq, but he can cook up all sorts of intentions and say it's because this, that, the other thing, and the like, you see. So how do you make a determination? Well, you can observe repeatable patterns, and you could also even control for certain things. Now, history and politics are not like chemistry in a laboratory where you can control for a variable, hold a constant, and test it and see, and like. And yes, sometimes that does happen. Sometimes you can see that. For instance, you notice U.S.-supported military and security forces and the death squads in many of these countries have been used repeatedly to destroy popular reformist movements and insurgencies. They haven't been used against plutocrats and big landowners. They've been used against student leaders and peasant leaders and clergy who speak out and journalists who speak out critically and trade union leaders and the like. So you can see by who they're killing what their political interests are and what their political intent is. Second, U.S.-sponsored forces, not U.S. forces, but these forces that are backed and trained, advised, equipped, and financed by the United States and all these various countries, they've never been used to assist a popular reformist or revolutionary government or movement in any of these countries. Not in Guatemala, not in Nicaragua, not in Iran, not in Iraq, not in Palestine or Lebanon, not in South Africa or South Korea, not anywhere. And that tells you something about intent. Reformist coalition groups, popular movements that wanted land reform, wanted public services, wanted health care for their people, wanted education for their people. You say you want to help the people of the world, and you're killing the people who are organizing, trying to resist the oligarchs to help. That tells you something about their intent. But no help for any of these countries. Not in China either, until China opens its economy to massive private investment with millions of Chinese workers laboring without a contract, without protection, 12 hours a day for minimum pay, miserable pay. Not until China privatized and dismantled most of its public health system and its other human services. U.S. forces never assisted revolutionary Vietnam. In fact, we spent 20 years trying to destroy revolutionary Vietnam. But today, they're beginning to help and be friendly to them, same as China, because Vietnam is doing the same. The majority of Vietnamese workers in the fast-growing private sector, which is now more than two-thirds of the economy of Vietnam, are working. The majority of them are working without a contract. So you've really got these countries. So the U.S. plutocrats did win the Vietnam War. They're in there and turning Vietnam into a sweatshop. Not in Libya, they didn't help and never gave aid. Not when Colonel Gaddafi took over that country, kicked out the oligarchs, planted 40 million trees, put up health programs, education for women, land reform, and nationalized the oil industry. He became what? A pariah. He was demonized. He was one of the people on their hate list and hit list. Gaddafi, Allende, Trujillo in Panama, and Noriega, Milosevic in Yugoslavia, Saddam Hussein, even though Saddam Hussein was a CIA flunky and did much to destroy the democratic movement in Iraq. He then became an economic nationalist, and that put him on the same hit list. Now Gaddafi is recently opening up the country to Western investment, and suddenly he's being welcomed back into the family of nations. So there are these remarkably consistent patterns which show the kind of regimes. And here's another pattern. Look at the kind of regimes that U.S. rulers have supported. The ones most likely to win U.S. favor are those that are integrated into the global system of free market corporate domination. Those are called pro-West, friendly toward America. They leave their economies open to foreign penetration on terms that are singularly favorable to transnational corporate investors. They adopt neoliberal modes of maldevelopment that starve out the public sector. Chile under Pinochet, the Philippines under Marcos. That's okay, I got water. It's not water, my voice is just giving way. Zaire under Mobutu supported. Mobutu, who plundered, they estimate, $4 or $5 billion out of Zaire, now the Congo. Never a harsh word for him. The CIA was always at his beck and call because he opened up the country completely to the foreign investors, completely on terms favorable to them. Cheap labor, no taxes, no pollution or environmental controls, nothing like that. Anything you want to do, anytime, do it. Peru under Fujimori, South Africa under apartheid, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait under feudalism, Turkey, Pakistan, Nigeria under police state autocracies. I said that we can't experiment and test hypotheses as in a laboratory situation, but you see how you can actually do control. Sometimes actually, you actually do get a test where a variable is removed from the picture, and you can rerun a test. That does happen in history sometimes through the force of events, and that puts intent and motive to the test also. Thus, for instance, for decades, we were told that the United States needed enormous military budgets and military bases around the world to contain the Soviet communist menace that threatened to encircle and devour us. So U.S. militarism was an innocent reactive necessity born of communist aggression. That's what we were told. Some of us argued otherwise. Some of us said that if the Soviet Union were to disappear tomorrow, not thinking it was going to disappear, that the U.S. would still pursue a policy of imperialist domination. Well, history made its own laboratory test. The variable was removed from the equation. The Soviet Union was overthrown. And what did we have? What do we have today? A U.S. military budget that's bigger than ever, growing at a faster rate than during the Cold War. We have more military bases than we had during the Cold War. Whole new sets of military bases opening up in Central Asia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East. And we have pursued wars of intervention and control more violently and more frequently than ever, with a whole host of new enemies being conjured up. So it's not the Soviet Union, it was the empire, and it's not the empire, it's the interests of the financial global ruling class. Now there are those who present what I call the other variables argument. There are other variables involved, Parenta. You're being reductionist. You're trying to reduce everything to narrow material considerations. U.S. policy is not motivated exclusively by material considerations. There are other factors such as culture, ideology, or broader strategic considerations, or questions of morality. The Western intellectual world, the U.S. intellectual world, is overpopulated by people whose primary dedication is to deny, or at least diminish, the importance of material interest by conjuring up these other considerations. Somebody's already been using that one. I mean, you think you could get a glass, you know, a little dignity. So undignified to swig in front of a... Hey, so how am I doing, all right? Hey. Grazie, grazie mille. Well, what's the wrong? This is the one with the other water, and I know what I'm doing. I can see them both much better than you back there. We never said, those of us who are urging people to consider a class analysis, that class interests are the only thing that motivates political protagonists, but it's a major, powerful one. So could we talk about it once in a while? To show that something is central or very important does not oblige us to prove that it's the only thing that's ever in operation in any political or historical context. That's not true. We don't have to do that. And why are we to assume that these other factors, such as culture, ideology, ethnic identity, gender oppression, or morality, are themselves separate and apart from material forces? They too are influenced by material forces. Why must we assume they're supposedly exclusive or in competition with class interests and power? Culture is mediated through material morphology and often shaped by dominant material interests. Culture is not something that's mutually exclusive of economic forces. Much of what you call culture is elite-dominated, propagated, and imposed on us. To the assertion that intervention is not motivated by narrow economic interests, but by broader strategic interests, the policy wonks like to always bring that word in. Oh, it's a strategic interest that brings us there. It's not the oil, it's a strategic thing. Because that area is so strategically important, the Middle East. I said, yeah, what makes it so strategically important? It's the oil. And when you develop oil in when you find oil in Antarctica, that'll become strategically important too, if it's not melted down and we're not all dead from it. Those who say it's not it's the broader strategic interest, I would ask, what in the world is so narrow about material economic interest? Why is that called a narrow interest? Why these spatial metaphors? Material economic interests consume much of the necessity of life and society. Whole populations and nations have been wiped out in the pursuit of ruling class wealth. Much of your waking day, most of your waking day, is having to deal with your narrow economic interests, right? Like paying the rent and getting to work and feeding yourself and all that. Why think that's not important? The planet's ecology itself has been put at risk because of economic interests plundering it the way they are. And why would strategic interest be considered broader? What is a strategic interest? A nation has a strategic interest in a region because the region has some value to it, or because the region has entree to another region that has value. And often what gives value are the economic resources or class control considerations. So I pretty much said what I had to say for the night. Did I talk too long? Let me just point out to you the question of Iraq, for instance. There's three basic reasons why the U.S. ruling class supports the invasion and occupation. And these are the same three basic reasons that dictate U.S. interventionist policy everywhere else. First, it's the systemic monopoly. Iraq was one of those countries. Here's another way you can measure intent. Every country that's been hit by the U.S. has been a country that's tried to get out from under the global corporate free market investment system. That's what Libya was trying to do. That's what Nicaragua under the Sandinistas were trying to do. That's what Panama was trying to do under Torrijos and even under Noriega. It had a left-wing military. They were making all sorts of reforms. Every one of them is trying to be self-defining and self-developing. And Iraq was doing the same thing. As I said, Saddam Hussein, even though he was the CIA's poster boy, he then began to commit economic nationalism. He kept the entire economy government-owned. He kept the oil industry government-owned. And, you know, they appeal, these politicians appeal to people, say, we got to go in there, you need gas for your car, right, and all that. These countries will sell you. They'd be happy to sell to the U.S. market. It's not that. It's that they don't want to, it's that the cartels don't want to have to buy the oil from them, then jack up the price and make a profit as middlemen. They want to own the oil. They want to own it that's in your ground. The oil, our oil happens to be in your ground. But we want it. Rumsfeld said that about Saddam Hussein and Iraq. He said, it's a Stalinized economy. I thought that was a fascinating use of term there. Mainly, it was publicly owned. And what you have happening now is billions of dollars in public capital is being privatized, handed over. And that includes the hotels, utilities, factories, the media system, the whole infrastructure of their airline system. All of that is being stripped. The Iraqis are being stripped of every trace of public capital they have. And all they're being left with is the debt, just like us. It's just the way they're doing it here in other places, but more ruthlessly there. So that's the first thing. Iraq committed the sin of trying to be self-developing and self-defining. Second, Iraq was a bad example when it did that. Not just the essence of that happening, but it was a bad example for other countries, so it has to be contained. Third, there's the straight old colonization resource plunder. After rolling back these countries and maintaining this global system, you do it for a reason, and you go in there and you take out. Iraq has the second largest reserve of oil in the world after Saudi Arabia. Iran, as far as we know, Iran is third. And you know that if the Iraqi people's resistance had not pinned down those U.S. forces in Iraq, the U.S. would be in Iran today. They would. And that war is not going well at all in Iraq. The casualties are still increasing. And when George Bush says we have to stay the course, I don't know if you heard me on the radio today, I made this point, excuse me for repeating myself. I said, stay the course. Stay the course. The U.S. military in this last week has just, they call it, evacuated from five cities. You see, it's really called retreat. When you got a war going on and people shooting at you and you leave, you are retreating. But the U.S. military, we never retreat there. You come on outside and say that, boy. They retreating, including a city of the size of Fallujah. They're not winning that war. They're not sustaining it. When the other side takes over cities, they're winning. So you got this straight old colonial resource plunder. 113 billion barrels of very fine quality crude. Now that's worth, under today's prices, that's worth anywhere between $4 and $5 trillion. Now, brothers and sisters, I submit that $4 trillion is not a narrow economic interest. It's a huge, motherload, humongous economic interest. That's what it is. It's wealth. It's wealth that Halliburton, Dick Cheney, George Will, it's wealth for these guys. And that's, if you want to know the dangerous addiction that's ruining America, it's not heroin, cocaine, or crime, or anything like that. It's wealth. these guys got their hundreds of millions and they want more, and they got their billions and they've got to have more billions, and they want it and they want it and they want it, and they don't realize they're going to die anyway, and that you can get all this wealth. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look ye on the wreckage. You're just a little pile of dust now, aren't you? Well, all three of these, somewhat different but interrelated, are not competitive, not mutually exclusive. The presence of one interest does not preclude the other. And why would we say that moral considerations are mutually exclusive and they cancel out these economic realities and these class power realities? Sure, they parade moral professions. All nations, all leaders, all movements, all individuals believe in their own virtue, think they're operating from the highest viewpoint. And the ruling class mass line in this country just talks about our virtue and tells the people that we are so virtuous. We're here to help these poor downtrodden people. We're here to help these poor people in the Middle East, self-government and democracy. I mean, here are civilizations that have been around for 6,000 years, and we're going to show them how to live and show them how to do these things. And they leave out the fact that Iran had a democratic movement and had a parliament back in 1950. They forget to mention not only Iran, but Iraq had a democracy. They were perfectly capable. They perfectly well knew how. And it would have been a very successful country. And it would have had a great standard of living and a great democracy if the U.S. hadn't gone in there with using Saddam Hussein to destroy them, as I've already discussed. So, no ruling empire stands naked in its ruthless expropriation. They all adopt a self-justifying, non-falsifiable ideological gloss, which some of their leaders and proponents may even believe. They may even believe, oh, sure, they believe, yeah, we're doing this. This is helping. This brings prosperity. This is good for everybody. Saddam Hussein was a torturer, but, you know, it's very easy for them to do that. Benjamin Franklin talked about that. He said, man is such a creature of reason. When he wants to go out and do something, he can always find a reason to justify it, you know. The Project for a New American Century in their Rebuilding America's Defenses, which of course is the whole Bush administration, is from the Project of Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, they're all signed on to this. They're all members. But one of the things, I don't want to go into all that, I've covered some of that. One of the things they pointed out was they suggested that the United States might see fit to develop biological weapons that can target specific genotypes. That means gene pools of people, specific pools, in order to transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. Now, there's the magic of a ruling class morality. There it is. In the hands of others, biotech weapons like that would be instruments of terror. In the hands of these people, they would be instruments of virtue, a politically useful tool. How righteous is the sword of our Lord? Well, what are we to do, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters? We're to organize, we're to get our voices heard, we're to show our anger, we're to work at the grassroots, we're to work, impact on our leaders, increase our base and impact on those above. We are facing a reactionary force. You want to know where, how to do that? All those people who came up before I spoke, they're showing what to do. People who are busily doing things do not ask, well, what can we do? I know we also ask, what can we do to be effective, to be more effective and all that? And that's a hard one, because we are facing a reactionary force that's going all the way. These guys are playing for keep. And that pussy willow democratic leadership doesn't understand that. You know? I saw John Curry quote, it was some time back, but he said, Well, when all of this is over, George Bush and I will probably sit down over a six-pack and have a old debate about the Patriots versus the Rangers. And I'm going, cloying, disgust. What do you think you're doing, you jackass? They're going to kick you up one side, down the other, you know. But we have to work in broad-based coalitions with everybody, including Democrats. I have friends who are Democrats, liberals. They are sounding like me lately. You could hear they are angry, they are in high dudgeon, they are really moving. And there's a lot of those people. And if you looked at the Democratic Convention, the people in the audience were way ahead of that asshole leadership that was up there on the stage. Yeah. You know. Every time I think of the Democratic Party, I think of Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde, when he came, made his trip to America, he landed in New York and people said, oh, you got to go visit Niagara Falls, or you got to go up to Niagara Falls. It's one of the wonders of the world. It's one of the great wonders. So Oscar Wilde went up to Niagara Falls and he took one look at Niagara Falls and he said, Niagara Falls is the second greatest disappointment that American brides experience on their honeymoon. And that's what the Democratic Party is to me. It's the second greatest disappointment. We're getting screwed and really not very well either.